Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, heading for Rwanda. Britain's Prime Minister says asylum seekers could start to be sent to East Africa by July. But what sort of life would they face there? And could they even get a job? Also, BP is being taken to court in the UK by an Iraqi man who says the oil company's use of flaring gave his son a fatal cancer. And do you remember the Greek crisis of the 2010s? Greeks protested loudly then against austerity, economic hardship and harsh conditions in return for a bailout. But now the country seems poised to start paying back its debts. Plus, Elon Musk and the Australian government at loggerheads over a violent video shown on social media. And Dominica becomes the latest Caribbean nation to decriminalise same-sex relations. So will it get a financial boost now from LGBT tourism? And remember, you can email us at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. Now, after a very long battle, the UK government has managed to get Parliament to pass its new law, allowing it to send people arriving on small boats to Rwanda to have their asylum claims processed there. The news came just as five people died in a boat trying to cross from France to Britain. The BBC's Tom Symonds was watching another inflatable vessel leave France earlier today.
We're just north of Calais on a beach near Gravelines, near a large nuclear power station. And as we were arriving, a boat appeared in the distance there, passing from left to right, trying to head across to the UK. And as that boat went out, this French naval vessel tracked it and got in the way of it in the UK to stop it going across. And then as we were watching, this large group of migrants that are now on the boat came across the beach and all climbed on board the boat there now. There is a small outboard motor that we can see at the back that they are trying to start. It is a tiny, tiny engine. That's a boat with, I don't know, what's that, 30 people on board? That one now appears to be making some progress. I think the motor is now working and they are trying to get out into the main channel.
Tom Symonds there. Well, the intention of this new law is to deter people from attempting that sort of crossing. But even if the new plan passes a number of further legal challenges, the capacity of the proposed facility in Rwanda is 200 people each year, representing just 0.7% of small boat arrivals last year. It's intended that the people sent there, who come from many backgrounds and countries, would settle and get jobs in Rwanda. But how real a prospect is that? In the Rwandan capital, Kigali, there are opposing views.
People from different areas always bring different ideas.
Where are you going to find the jobs for these people? We ourselves, we've graduated, but we've not yet secured jobs. We are out there searching for jobs.
So can Rwanda's economy offer them that option? I've been talking to our Africa business producer, Claire Mutinji. Is the economy set up to deal with that?
Well, Roger, I think that's the big question, because when you look at how Rwanda is set up, the economy, it's a small economy, if I should say, in East Africa. And in as much as the government, that is the Rwanda government, saying that they're willing to welcome these refugees, and they say they will receive training and be introduced into the job market, it really leaves a question, because we see unemployment rates in Rwanda, especially for the young people, reaching up to 20%. So if the locals don't have jobs, and then you're saying you're bringing people from outside the country to train them and give them jobs, what does that mean? And, you know, there's sort of disquiet and, people are concerned where you're bringing people, you're saying you'll give them jobs, you'll train them, but we locals don't have jobs. So I think that's the big question, and it will be interesting to see what sort of sectors these people will be trained in, because Rwanda is a mixed economy. There's agriculture.
Well, I was going to ask, what are the kind of things that they need, that they do there? There is agriculture, clearly, but it's been promoted also as a kind of tech hub. Is there any truth in that?
Yes, Rogers. Yeah, Rwanda is an upcoming tech hub. It also has a service industry. Tourism is also another sector that it's quite big. So it will be interesting to see what these refugees will be trained at, because it's a mixed economy. And will the people have the technical skills? Do they have the technical skills? Are they skilled workers? Or are we talking about taking these people maybe to school for technical training? So in as much as Rwanda is an upcoming tech hub, there's a lot of stuff going on there. We have a huge finance sector. We have the Kigali International Finance Center there. We have banks there. We have, you know, a growing ICT hub. It's been billed as a future of East Africa, if I should say so, because of its economic growth over the years. It will be interesting to see whether these migrants will be trained as skilled workers and what sort of sectors they'll be going into.
Well, I was going to ask you about growth, because if an economy is going to absorb a number of workers, and there may not be that many, I suppose, people coming to Rwanda, of these people we're talking about, but is it able to absorb further people looking for jobs?
Well, experts say, and also what we know, critics have argued that it's sort of impossible, if I should say so, because already we are seeing a country where unemployment is still high. And it's a small country, significantly small compared to other countries in East Africa. And when you have not satisfied your, you know, sort of internal market, your people don't have these jobs, and you are talking about bringing refugees to give them the jobs that are there. So it's an issue that raises a lot of questions, because in as much as Rwanda is a growing economy, we've seen the World Bank saying the economy is projected to grow to about 7%. It has had steady economic growth over the years compared to other countries in the region. But when you have such a small economy that cannot satisfy internal demand, and then we have extra pressure coming in, we've seen critics argue that it's sort of impossible to, you know, absorb all these migrants. And who knows how will this end up?
Claire Mutinji there in Nairobi. Now, the practice of flaring in the oil industry is controversial. It involves burning off waste gases and claims that this causes toxic pollution. But now a man in southern Iraq is taking one of the world's biggest oil companies to court over it. Hussein Jalloud alleges the burning off of gas at a BP-run field in Iraq caused his son Ali's leukemia. A year on from his son's death, he's been talking to the BBC.
It's been a year since Ali died. May God rest his soul. It was a very sad year for the family, for me, his mother, and his brothers too. Ali was an unforgettable person. He was my backbone. I depended on him in my work, my life, and for everything in the house. All our days we live now are sad. He is not easy to forget. Ali was very smart in everything he did. I need him here, but this is God's will. It's been a very sad year for me.
لكن ليس فيها إرادة الله سبحانه وتعالى لا. فقط مرت السنة حزينة جدا علي أنا.
Hussein Jalloud there. Well, he is able to bring the claim in the UK courts because BP's headquarters is in the UK. The BBC's Esme Stallard, who's been investigating this case, gave me the details.
So Hussein Jalloud lives within Iraq in Rumaila, a village which is in the southeast of Iraq, and that's in a Rumaila oil field, which is partly run by BP. And he sadly lost his 21-year-old son, Ali, last year to leukemia. And what he's alleging in this letter of claim is that flaring, which is gas burning that happens sometimes when oil is produced, caused his son's leukemia and then ultimately his death.
What's BP said about this?
So BP said that they are concerned, obviously, about the allegations, but they've been working with the operator to reduce flaring and also the emissions associated with that. But this statement that they've made is actually a reiteration of a statement that they made a few years ago when the BBC documentary into flaring within this region demonstrated the true scale of the issue. And what Mr. Jalloud has said in response to that is, well, they've made this statement before and he still continues to see flaring and black smoke and fires on the oil field on an almost daily basis.
So is this the first time that someone like this, an individual, has taken a big oil company like this to court over flaring and its consequences?
We believe so globally. We think it's the first time. There has been examples where governments have taken firms to court over breaching regulations around it, but this is the first time we think an individual is seeking compensation over the actual impacts of flaring, the health impacts of it.
And Esme, if he wins, what are the consequences? What could be the outcome of the case?
Well, that's a really interesting question here, because if BP admits liability, or if he was to win in a court, if it ends up proceeding to that stage, that could then open the floodgates for other families within the region to take BP to court over the impact. So it could at least result in there being a reduction in flaring within the region, but it also could make other major oil firms reflect on their activities in other parts of the world that have very high flaring. For example, Venezuela is one of them.
Esme Stallard there. Right, let's have a look at what's been going on the markets. And joining me, very pleased to say, is Fiona Sincotta, financial market analyst. Fiona, welcome to the programme. I mean, I suppose the thing that's dominating thoughts, really, is the rush of earnings. It's earnings season, of course, and some big American companies announcing. What are we learning from earnings?
Yeah, so I think, you know, very, as you said, corporate earnings very much in focus, and they are just helping the US stock market tick higher today. We've had numbers from General Motors, PepsiCo, United UPS, which have all come in ahead of expectations. So some encouraging signs, but I think more broadly so far, earnings season has been a bit mixed, but today is definitely one of the better days.
And we've got a big one coming down the line, not out yet, and that's Tesla. What are the feelings about what Tesla's going to reveal?
Yes, so this is really keenly awaited, I mean, but probably for all the wrong reasons. We know that deliveries in the first quarter were down 8.5% year on year. So, you know, expectations are pretty low. Earnings are expected to come in at around 55 cents a share, which is down from 85 cents a share the year before. Revenues also expected to come in down. And this is just sort of highlighting that, you know, the price cuts that we've been seeing at Tesla have not really been having the desired impact, and this intense competition in the sector is really meaning that Tesla's struggling. The share price is down around 40% so far this year.
Well, we'll bring you the actual figure of what Tesla's earnings are, of course, in our later programmes today. But looking further, a bit of M&A, mergers and acquisitions, JD Sport, big name here in the UK, but they're buying Hibbett, which is a big company in the US.
Yes, exactly. So JD Sport is looking to really deepen its reach into the US. And this is a deal that's worth $1 billion, as it really aims to become sort of a global sports fashion powerhouse. Now, we know JD has already sort of acquired in the US. This is going to be its fourth significant move into the US market, which can be quite a difficult market to crack. But it looks like JD is doing well with the US generating around a third of its revenue so far.
Fiona, thanks so much for being with us. Fiona Sincotta there, financial market analyst, giving us a sense of what's going on the market.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It's today. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, Greece was the poster child of the failure of the European economic experiment. Its near economic collapse in the 2010s, an object lesson in the challenges of bringing very different countries together under the euro umbrella. The effort to sort all that out and the finances was painful and politically controversial. Well, that's the sound of rioters in Athens back in 2016 protesting against the government's austerity measures. But things have changed. Reuters is now reporting that Greece plans an early repayment of up to 5 billion euros of bailout loans to eurozone countries this year as it seeks a return to normality. It's a small fraction, of course, of the estimated 280 billion euros lent to Greece during the crisis. And it's all on the condition, of course, that Greece impose tough austerity measures. But it is a big turnaround. And one of the country's most respected think tanks, AOBI, is now predicting the economy there is going to be growing by 2.1%. Joining me now is Nico Vettis, director of AOBI. Nico, thanks for being with us here on World Business Report. Now, it's interesting, your projection about expansion, 2.1%, somewhat below what the government have been talking about, 2.9%. So are you saying the recovery perhaps isn't as good as predicted?
Well, the recovery is strong. We estimate that Greece is going to grow this year about four times more than the average of the eurozone, and more or less at the same rate that it grew last year in 2023. For this to happen, however, because consumption cannot be as strong as it was in the past couple of years, investment has to increase significantly. And that's our story. We believe that Greece can continue on a path of convergence to the eurozone average. As you mentioned before, Greece has been through some really, really difficult years, starting already in 2010. Three consecutive rescue programs. The banks were closed. Capital controls were imposed. The Greek economy was below investment grade for 13 years, and it has only recovered this investment grade. So it is now on a strong recovery path following the 10-year debt crisis, following that because of its incoming tourism, it was hit very hard from the pandemic. It is growing.
But Nico, I was going to say, I mean, you know, you talk about the need for investment, but investors are going to look and say, okay, maybe there's a bit of repayment coming. Now, that's good. But as you say, it's only just come out of junk status as far as investment analysis is concerned. I mean, this isn't necessarily back to full success, is it?
Not yet. And for sure, the plan is of what economic policy aims to do is to raise significantly the growth rate in Greece from what it was during the last few decades and almost double it. For that to happen, you need structural reforms in the public sector and especially in the functioning of markets.
But isn't that exactly what the government's been doing, which is what caused all the anxiety? The restructuring were part of the austerity measures demanded by the IMF and others, and that was the pain.
Austerity is one thing. Structural reforms that are going to open up the markets and they're going to modernize the public sector is what Greece still needs. This is actually supported by the Greek part of the recovery fund, which is, as you know, the EU-wide plan for how to strengthen Europe. And this is a significant injection of funds in Greece, but it's also an opportunity for further reforms. It is not guaranteed how strong Greece is going to grow over the next 5 or 10 years. However, it is on stable ground right now, and it has a good chance.
Well, let's see what happens with it. We'll probably come back to you to find out. Nico, thank you so much for being with us. Nico Vettis, there, director of AOBI, speaking to me on the line there from Athens. Now, Elon Musk is no stranger to stand-up vitriolic rows. Well, his latest is with Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. The owner of X, formerly Twitter, has now clashed with Mr. Albanese over the use of a video of a stabbing attack in a church in Australia, as I heard from Peter Ryan, ABC's senior business correspondent in Sydney.
There was a fairly distressing and violent stabbing at a church in Sydney's southwest around about this time last week, where a cleric, Mari Emanuel, was stabbed allegedly by a 16-year-old. The video went viral up there on YouTube and Instagram, and this is the problem. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and others want to have this video removed. Australia's eSafety Commissioner, went to Australia's federal court the other day seeking an injunction ordering X, formerly known as Twitter, to remove this. Now, X has agreed to take it down until Wednesday, but the order says that this has to be removed permanently. The issue is that they've agreed, or X has agreed, to remove it for Australia, but it's still available anywhere else in the world. So anyone who had a VPN or a virtual private network would be able to get hold of this and, I suppose, technically rebroadcast it, which is the whole problem of violent video going viral.
Well, I suppose the issue that X has is one of freedom of speech. I mean, Elon Musk has pushed this line before.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Elon Musk, who controls Twitter or X, he's pretty much mocked the Australian government. He made a post to his 181 million followers hitting back at this federal court order from Australia, which has told him that he needs to take down these images and video worldwide. He's posted a cartoon with his company on a path heading to a gleaming castle labelled free speech, the other path heading to a castle covered in stormy clouds labelled censorship. So you get the drift. In other words, Elon Musk sees this takedown order from down under in Australia as censorship. And rather than complying, he said that his concern is that if any country is allowed to censor content for all countries, then what is it to stop any country from controlling the entire internet? So this has earned a rebuke from Anthony Albanese, the Australian Prime Minister, and as we say in this business, it's escalated into a war of words.
Yeah, indeed. Anthony Albanese hasn't exactly been complimentary about Elon Musk.
That's right. He's called him an arrogant billionaire who's put his own massive ego ahead of the welfare of others, not just Australians, but others around the world. And having seen just a little bit of this video, it's incredibly distressing and violent. And, of course, it came just a day after there were those terrible stabbings at Bondi Junction in Sydney in the shopping centre where six people were killed. So going through incredibly complicated times here where violent video goes viral almost immediately and not subject to the normal checks and balances that you would have in normal journalism or broadcasting, right out there and, you know, right into the inboxes or the screens, potentially even of young children.
So, Peter, what happens next? I mean, the eSafety Commissioner in Australia, I understand, is pushing further legal action. What are the next stages?
Well, the eSafety Commissioner has got until, I think, tomorrow Australian time. That's what X has agreed to remove this video. But after that, I think we're into a long period of discussion about censorship. Now, the move by Anthony Albanese hasn't been entirely backed. There have been some even independent politicians who've been saying this is an issue of censorship. People should be able to see, hear and read whatever they want. And once again, the message has been, if you don't want to see this video, don't click on the links, don't go onto social media and you won't see it. But it just does come down to this issue. Here we have the Prime Minister of Australia down under, a very small country, not that much power, up against a tech giant of X. And I think we've got a pretty good idea of who might be winning this battle.
Peter Ryan there in Sydney. Now, as Africa has recently seen a number of new laws passed in various countries increasing criminal penalties against gay people, there seems to be a different, contrary trend in the Caribbean. Dominica has become the latest Caribbean country to decriminalise same-sex relations. The High Court there ruled parts of the law that criminalised same-sex activity went against the country's constitution. That's not only good news for the island's gay community, but also potentially for its tourist industry. A 2021 report by the business group Open for Business found that LGBT plus discrimination was costing parts of the Caribbean up to $4.1 billion a year in tourism, or up to 5.7% of GDP. But in 2022, Cuba legalised gay marriage. The same year, Antigua and Barbuda and two other Caribbean nations decriminalised gay sex. I'm joined now by Darren Byrne, founder and CEO of LGBT Travel Agency, out of office.com. Darren, thanks for being with us here on World Business Report. First of all, I guess you're obviously welcoming the change of the situation in Dominica.
That's right. It's great news, and I absolutely applaud the activists who brought the case to court. There are obviously few countries than ever where it's illegal to be gay, and that's a good thing. And the Caribbean is undoubtedly a beautiful destination, but it is one that has felt off limit to many LGBTQ plus travellers for years because of its antiquated laws. So it's absolutely, absolutely welcome. And I know there'll be people in the Caribbean who are gay themselves, and it will be a massive relief to them to know that things are changing for the better.
But indeed, but the financial benefit of this is clear, I guess. I mean, that report from Open for Business certainly suggested there was a penalty for anti-LGBT laws. I mean, tourism, obviously, the area you're in on this, is tourism going to be boosted as a result of this change?
I would like to think so. Many of our clients at outofoffice.com are from the US and they will want to travel to the Caribbean, but many have been put off from doing so because of the laws that have been in place. So undoubtedly, there will be more people that want to travel. You know, there is clear evidence that people boycott places where it is illegal. And unfortunately, that's just the way. And that has a knock-on effect for tourism dollars.
I think it's actually true. In 2011, I think there was a case two American men were prosecuted in Dominica, visitors for involvement in being gay, fundamentally. And that obviously is changing. How quickly, though, is the message going to get through? I mean, will people just go, oh, yes, it's fine now? Or will there be a kind of waiting for things to perhaps even out, perhaps see how it goes down, that kind of thing?
I think probably the latter. I mean, you know that in many places, the law doesn't always match the reality. And, you know, unfortunately, there are very long-standing ingrained homophobia within the Caribbean. And I think in some places in the Caribbean, I think, you know, there are other islands which have been far more progressive and have been welcoming for years, like Curaçao, Puerto Rico, Aruba, St. Martin. So that's where we do see clients wanting to go to more. But that is a good thing that, you know, Dominica has made these changes, and hopefully that will boost its tourism dollars in due course.
And how much, in a way, does this matter? Because people might say, well, you know, there are plenty of other tourists, non-gay tourists, personally happy to go there, perhaps gay tourists who conceal what they are. Does it actually matter? Does it make much difference financially in terms of the tourist dollar?
Well, yes, it does, in fact, because LGBT couples tend to have 23% more disposable income and therefore spend more dollars per person in destination. And so actually, if you could get more LGBT travellers to your destination, you are going to see more tourism dollars as a result of it.
And are you seeing, say, in the Caribbean now, is there a general feeling that this is a welcoming place, perhaps in a way that, as we're mentioning, Africa, perhaps some African countries aren't?
I think so. I think it's going in the right direction. There's still a long way to go, as I said. And, you know, we can see that the Caribbean is still missing out on those billions in tourism revenue. But ultimately, those billions are there for the taking. And if the Caribbean wants to welcome LGBTQ travellers, then LGBTQ travellers will want to travel there and will support them.
Will you be heading to Dominica anytime soon?
I'd love to. I'd love to try. I love trying destinations, even sometimes places where it's illegal to be gay. It is possible to travel. So it is just about making sure you know the right destinations. And that's exactly what our company is there for, to help LGBTQ travellers navigate the world safely.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us. Darren Byrne there, founder and CEO of the LGBT travel agency outofoffice.com, reflecting on that change in Dominica, the latest Caribbean country to decriminalise same-sex relations, and perhaps the financial benefit they might get from that. That's it from World Business Report.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.